with final approval on everything, so we sort of had, you know, and we had so much time because we've been sitting on the movie for so long. So we really, it's kind of a natural. I've seen other people go through it, the bad version of it. I'm happy with our materials. It goes the trailer just goes close enough to smell like the movie, and it promises the, you know, promises some of the electricity of a thriller, you know. I think it's pretty accurate. The poster I love. I love the one sheet.
I mean, the, you know,
the sort of Gerhard Richter
photo
of George. Yeah.
The second, that Toronto viewing, like I said, I guess I'm just not, I don't have the brain cells, but I'm not smart enough to have gotten your film the first time. It just took me
a second viewing.
Maybe it's because of my, you know, as Bill Clinton was talking about, we'd all have happier lives, we'd all be better people, we'd certainly be more productive if sleep deprivation were not a constant.
I was going to ask you. I'm actually really curious because every time I mean, when you post and when you travel, when do you sleep? Do you ever sleep? I can't sleep anymore. I can't sleep anymore either.
5 hours. Maybe six.
God, six is a.
They're luxury. Yeah.
But yeah, and you go. I mean, if you add moving around to that.
Yeah. You live in one place, or what do you mean?
No, but I mean moving around. The last couple of weeks I've been moving around, and I mean anytime you add time zones to that already fragile.
Did you like Manolo Dargis's review? I thought that was really good because it caught how much joy it is to be in your movie.
I love reading her reviews anyway. So it's a lot of context, but yeah, no, it's good. She's a great writer.
So your movie could go on for 4 hours, and I would be delighted. Seriously,
don't say that.
It could. I would love to stay in that world because it's so complex, so fascinating, so much of a payoff. Sidney Pollack, everybody, that I could really. What I'm hoping is that you'll tell me that there's a 2-hour and 45-minute Michael Clayton coming out of the DVD.
Not one more. Two scenes that came out. That was it.
Okay.
No, there's no extra. In fact, we're going to do the DVD without any extra thing at all, I think. I don't even know if we're going to do the commentary or what we're going to do.
You know what I'm saying, though, about it? You want to live in the movie.
I can't say that, but yeah, but I mean, there's things that, like a lot of people hated K Street show, the one that George and Steven did.
I thought that was really good.
I could watch that wall to wall all day long. There was something hypnotic about these people. I know what
I'm going to interrupt. Did you even take an order now?
I'm going to eat. You going to eat?
Oh, sure.
What are you going to have? I'm going to have this, like, healthy Eggs Benedict thing. Is that any good? I've never seen that. Yeah, is it good?
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Let me have it. Can I get some Tabasco on the side with that?
Tabasco on the side.
Yeah. Is there like a small fruit plate? Every time I order fruit plates, like a massive.
No.
I never can eat it all. Is there a small one? Can I get like a just a
something? Yeah.
It doesn't scare me. Okay.
Every user, how are you?
Just a plain omelet with black olive or something like that.
You got it. Yeah. And toast? Any toast for you?
No thanks.
Perfect.
Maybe a small fruit plate also.
Well, of course. Then I put this back and I get you another fruit.
Thank you.
I'll meet you at the car.
Anyway, but I mean, just thank you anyway for.
Sorry. Turn this off. Right.
I'm putting the Denby thing back up. I mean, thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
The what?
Putting the Denby review back up.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, he's the best reviews, the best reactions to the movies are, they can take you into what it really was like watching it. It's not just your conclusions, but how you really were feeling as you watched it. I think that's really important, you know, because people are often conveying that when they talk to each other out of the street. You know, here's what I really felt as I was watching.
I'm fine. I'm reading them this last 2 weeks in a really retail mentality where I'm looking for quotes. Reading them different than us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I mean, most of the reviews I read are in the Times. I actually like the lineup in the Times. I like the way it's set up right now. I think it's a really good balance.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody, you know what everybody's voice is there. They're fairly consistent. I think it's the best era they've had there in a long, long time.
Yeah.
And a good review from Kenny Turan today, which was.
Oh, great.
Unexpected. So that's good. So I'm like really just curious, like, about how do you do this? I mean, how do you get over? How do you get paid?
Well, the advertising.
Right. And is it on a constant curve, or do you have seasons? Like, do you bulk up in the Academy season? Do you charge different rates?
Yeah. I go to a different rate plan. October 1st.
Do you do all that yourself, or do you have somebody else who handles it?
This year, thankfully. Otherwise, I honestly would be, I don't know, I mean, this is the third year, and I have a woman named Heather Wood, who's extremely bright.
Good morning. How are you? Pardon me for you?
Wrong table.
Sorry. No problem. And she's helping me do it. I have a girlfriend who turned me on to her, and it's working out very nicely. She's augmenting and in some places running with the ball entirely on her own without my asking her to do this, that, and the other thing. So
it's just the two of you?
Totally, yeah. So I got to do like 8, 9, 10 stories a day, plus the screenings, plus everything else.
Plus the layout.
That's established as a template. I mean, if you're adding photos, I mean, I just pop that in. But, you know.
And when you add the other columnists in, when you add the other pieces in, all your son stuff and all those things, when you pop those
stopped.
In.
You stopped that. Stopped that, rather.
Yeah, no, he was sort of silent. I wondered what I was going to ask you. He's been silent for a while.
He's in Syracuse University writing a column for the Daily Orange now.
Good. Well, it's a media school.
Yeah. He's at the New House.
How old is he now?
19.
Yeah, my son's 20.
Yeah. So you have done not just an excellent first film, you've done an excellent film. You really have.
Thank you.
There's no question about that. And anybody that goes looking for that adult season thing is going to get that in spades, and nobody's going to come out. It's just that I think it's so complex and rich and full of great stuff, really good stuff, really well thought out stuff that just maybe dense people like me need to see it at the same time. That's the only thing I'm thinking. And it's me. I'm not putting it on you, man. I'm saying it's me. I'm just not... Or maybe I was just sleep deprived when I first saw it. Again, that's entirely impossible.
I've had that experience many times.
Scenario. What?
I've had that experience where I've really missed something.
Yeah. So George's film got pushed back.
Yeah. I mean, I think he's
but that's supposed to be really good, I heard.
Yeah,
somebody saw it in September.
Yeah, no. I think it's just, it's too much work. It's a huge movie. I mean, it's a huge movie. He's scoring, spotting, cutting, picking up his, like, you know, his reshoots. At the same time, he's doing the Coen Brothers movie and selling us. I mean, I don't really know how. I don't know how three people could do that. He's just overworked.
What do you mean he is scoring?
You know, he's spotting. I mean, you're scoring. You're on
what
top of the
music. What
does the
word mean, spotting?
I mean, he's doing the music. Spotting music. He's picking all the spots for the music in the film.
Right.
He's got Randy Newman there. I mean, it's a really complicated process. And it's a movie that has to have it's a period movie, so it has to have this... You know, very specific score.
So you first go over with this composer, and you say, okay, here, and then they make a little note.
That's the first thing you do. The first thing you do, you sit down, and you talk about it generally, and then when you get specific, you sit through the film, and you go through all the places where there could be music.
Right.
I say, don't want anything here. Right. Let's try something here. You sort of just go through. It's the first sketch.
Right.
So they were spotting, then Randy Newman comes. But I don't know if Randy Newman's really fast, or I don't know how he gets. But plus he's in New York. So Randy Newman's in L.A., so they're back and forth, they're doing that. He's editing the film. I don't know where Steve Marioni is. I don't know where they are. God, I watch George and I get exhausted just thinking about it. So,
what's your favorite? You know one of my favorite existential dread music, which is what Errol Morris used it.
The Philip Glass music, yeah.
And yours is a kind of an existential dread movie on some...
I hope along the way, every now and then somebody like keys into it, and James's score is amazing. This movie was so...
Mm-hmm.
We screened it dry. We screened it dry for about 3 weeks after we first cut. Actually, longer than that. I showed it to Steve. I showed it to Soderbergh with no music on. I liked it with no music on at one point. Everyone was like... Very panicked about that, but it wasn't absorbent. It didn't take any music. It was really hard to score, and James came in. It took a long time to do it.
Now you're obviously a very disciplined guy, but I gotta tell you, I'm really, really disappointed to hear that there's not a longer version that I'm gonna see. I really want to see more of it. You're telling me you must have some. The Darling. We all know about the Darlings. You love them, but they don't serve the whole. So you had to take them out. There must be Darlings.
There's one scene that came out that was a great scene with he and Jennifer Ely, about an 8-page scene that was really great.
Mm-hmm.
You know her, she's fantastic. Great scene, they were great.
Mm.
There was a couple things in there that were really important, but I took it out. I cut it. I wanted it out in the end. I called Jennifer Ely. I called her up. I've never had to make this call before.
Yeah.
So I got up. She got, and she's like, she said, you know what? She goes, I knew when we were shooting it that it was never going to make it. I'm like, well, why the fuck didn't you tell me? I'm going to say going to save myself $150,000. She goes, she said it was just, she goes, it was such a great scene. It was so much fun, but it was so isolated. It was a really unpleasant scene that was actually open for misinterpretation. I mean, it's actually really interesting because it was a scene where he's got a fuck buddy at the firm, a senior partner, Jennifer Ely Wilson, and nobody knows about it.
Right.
And you sort of meet her early on, and just as he comes to the office, you sort of, you realize that she's just in passing. He's someone he doesn't know. He's introduced her, sort of an acquaintance.
Hmm.
Drop in the middle of the film. It's in the kitchen after sex, Chinese food, and it's just this really cold conversation between two people who really don't tell each other anything. Hmm. She's going to London. She hasn't told him. You can tell he actually is in many ways more into it than she is. It's just it's really unpleasant fuck buddy relationship.
Hmm.
And the biggest thing to lose out of it that he gives it at the end, he tells her this major fix that he had done for another partner. He sort of betrays his own Bushido. So he tells her this thing. You want to know about Jeff Gaffney? And he tells her the story. But as cold as the scene was, when we went to screen the movie, there were people along the way who were saying, you know, at the end of the film, when he leaves, when he gets in the cab, maybe he should go see her. Maybe he should, like, get with her. Maybe there's... You go, wait a minute. This scene was intended to be another thing that was wrong in his life. Not... If that's what he wins, then it's ashes. So,
You know, one of my favorite scenes is the Connecticut house with the family scene. Is that in Connecticut?
It's actually right where I grew up. It's in upstate New York, yeah. With his cop family.
Far upstate.
It's right where I grew up. It's actually 500 yards away from the house my parents still live in. It's Worley Heights.
Town?
Washingtonville? Orange County? Where are you from?
Wilton, Connecticut.
Oh, I know Wilton, Connecticut. Right.
And also Westfield, New Jersey.
All right, well, this is Orange County. It's by Newburgh, by Middletown, right in there. No, that house is right up the street from that's the neighborhood I grew up in.
What's really nice is you're quite interested. You definitely want to meet the screw up brother in the early part of the film because he's what the dead
is
about.
Yeah.
And it's very, very good and just right that you do meet him, but no in-depth discussion of who he is and what went wrong and why it's going wrong now. Just you just see how he impacts Clooney in terms of the kid. Clooney doesn't want the kid to be
right.
I guess even knowing him, you know?
Or he doesn't want to see him. I mean, yeah. What's he say? I'm in front of the kid. You're gonna do this now in front of the kid.
You know, it's interesting that people who are not very good at organizing their lives, who are in many ways considered failures, they are in touch with their childlike side, and they tend to be actually quite good with kids.
I agree with that completely. No, that's my experience as well.
Yeah.
No, there's no one better than, I mean, I've seen so many people like that.
Yeah.
Junkies are great with kids when they're in between, you know what I mean? They like, plus there's such a yearning for them to touch something that's unaffected.
Right.
You know, they want to have some... it's hard to say if it's cause or if it's... But no, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Benicio del Toro in this film I saw yesterday.
Same thing, right?
He's a guy who's he's always going to have the problem, but he's out and about to relapse, and he's fantastic with these kids.
Yeah, and I've seen that many, many times.
Yeah.
I've never thought about that specifically before, but yeah, it's true.
I mean, I thought maybe there might be another scene with the brother later or before or something.
Never shot, no. We were really down to the bone. This was...
how many days did you have?
40. 40 days, 70 locations. Outside, New York, winter.
I always ask every director of it. I always figure that as it is with writing, surely it is with filmmaking. But if I were to lay something out, I would want whatever my principle is, then I would want my Woody Allen
5 extra days to redo that, which I know I could get better if I could do it again. I'd work that into the schedule. Just so
well,
I know
they used to do it that way. MGM, everyone thinks reshoots is a new con. MGM used to be in every budget. They used to reshoot everything. Mm. Yeah, I know. We didn't have, I didn't have any reshoots. I left the opening sequence, that whole thing that happens under the voiceover. That was a later project. I left that open. And was there anything else that was open? No, I never called George back for one day. I never did looping with George. George never came back to an ADR stage. Once George, I wrapped George, that was it. We never came back in. I don't think we did. Do we do even any insert issues? No, just the opening.
What is technologically the absolute best, most foolproof way to mic people and get sound?
Now there's going to be a whole big breakthrough. You know? I mean, that's actually really interesting. The advancements in that are just enormous. But now I think what they're going to do is, because the way we were still doing on Clayton, but maybe even by now it's available. Instead of me putting a microphone on you, and having to have it go to a wireless, right? Which is really great, but it runs a certain distance. Like we're doing like if I'm in the back of a cab, through the back of the cab, and I want to be in the car, I can only put a focus on the car and the sound, but I'm going to be listening and it's going to break up. And now what they're going to do is they're going to put the microphone on you, but it's going to have a flash drive in it with SIM code in it, and it's going to be digital SIM code. So you're just going to be, we'll have this conversation, we'll finish the take, take the thing, put the card in the player, the mixer will take it, they'll sync everything up, and our dialogue is absolutely pristine for us. Mm. But the problem is, that's not what the world sounds like. The problem with it is that you end up with, this is sort of a real inside baseball kind of thing, but like our mix on Clayton is really unusual. I wanted the movie to sort of sound like an older mix, a New York mix. And you go into the room, and you're with all these guys, and they're trained and rewarded to use all their equipment. That's what everybody wants. They're trained to make it loud. They're trained to make it with the surrounds. It took Johnny and I 2 or 3 days, really.
Can I ask a favor, please?
Yes, sir.
Would you mind just for the while we're here? It won't be that long. Mm-hmm. Could please turn the music down.
I'll make sure.
The digital recording is gonna.
Oh, okay.
You know, the ambient sound.
I'll home turn it off just a bit.
Yeah, thank you.
That's perfect. God, this is good. Okay, great. A new treat. All right. But we took literally the first 2 or 3 days of Johnny and I in the mixing stage to get these guys to sort of beat that veneer out of them. We said, our mix comes from the front. We said, I don't want surrounds. We only use the surrounds a couple places in the whole film. Mm-hmm. The whole mix comes from the front, and it's very, so it relates to what we're saying, because if you have everything closed, Mike, it's not worldized. It doesn't have air in it. It doesn't sound like what the world sounds like to us. So, but then there's ways of making that, worldizing that. It's going to make shooting on streets and doing stuff like that a lot easier.
Great. That means faster, then it means more time to.
Less time to fuck up. Yeah. Hmm.
Not to get too inside baseball, also, but have you tried or been told about, or do you have interest in using this Red One camera?
The Red Cam? Look, all I know is I touched one. I know Steven's using it. I know Steven
now?
Soderbergh's shooting Che on it.
Okay.
I know Peter Jackson bought 40 of them or something. I don't know what he bought a whole bunch of them.
Because they're $17,000, right?
Someone sent me the website 2 years ago or something, the first time the website came up, and I looked at it, and it looked like something out of Sharper Image or something. It looked like, this is not a, didn't it look, you've seen it look like.
Didn't look big enough, you mean?
It didn't look like it was really part of the movie business. It looked like some other thing. And then Steven got completely excited about, and I realized it was the same thing that I'd seen. If it does all the things it says it does, it could be amazing. Look, Steven, the fact that Steven's shooting Che on it is a pretty big endorsement.
They have to be somewhere other than just Spain to be doing Cuba, aren't they?
They're in Puerto Rico right now.
Okay.
I think they love Spain.
All right.
Maybe wrong. I think they're in Puerto Rico.
I was so impressed with The Argentine and Gorilla, the two scripts. I gave them to William Goldman when I was in New York last time, just to see what he would say.
Did he read what he said?
I didn't hear back from him.
I've never read them. Stephen never showed them to me.
The first one is just a day by day, this happened, then that happens, experience thing of the successful revolution from 57 to late 58.
No, I know the whole, I know how they lay it out, I know what they're about. And then the other one's Bolivia, the failure.
Yeah. The first one is magnificent. It's really beautiful. I mean, it doesn't seem to say anything. It doesn't seem to be delivering anything you're supposed to actually, you know, that's tight and compact, like a
right.
thought or something. It's just, you, here we are. You're there with them, and that's it.
But you're catching a filmmaker at the absolute prime. I mean, whatever he's going to do is going to be.
Yeah.
I mean, there isn't anything of his I haven't wanted to see.
Yeah.
And gotten something out of.
No.
Did you like Bubble?
Very much.
Yeah, me too.
That was a comeback, as far as I was concerned. Yeah. I didn't like the Full Frontal one. I didn't. And he got mad at me for a while. Because I was, you know, I thought he had, you know, he was a gift from God there for a while. And then he went into that fallow period. And but that's natural, you know. You have.
I like Full Frontal. Yeah, I like Full Frontal too.
Okay.
But they're all, you know. You know, and German was German.
Yeah, yeah.
But this will be. This has got to be.
Mm-hmm.
This has got to be a great 4 hours of cinema. It has to be. In Spanish.
In Spanish, yeah. Well, I was actually saying out loud that I said it would be appalling if they were to do it with Spanish accented English.
I don't think you can do that anymore. I wonder if that's completely over now. I mean, have we gotten to the point? I mean, that's an interesting article tracing the sort of evolution of. What was the movie that did? Crimson Tide? Which was the one that where they did that trick where they flipped the languages over? Where all of a sudden you went in a certain point and the Russians were suddenly speaking English in a way you couldn't. They started speaking. It brings you to trace when the point of departure was for.
That was Durstan, if I'm not having two film professors.
Too geeky.
By Stanley Kramer.
In
German at Nuremberg.
That's right. That's right.
Maximum Michel, you know, German.
When they put the headphones on.
Translators.
That's right. That's right.
And then he zooms in at one particular moment and he starts speaking English. It's brilliant. Maybe the most brilliant thing is Stanley Kramer, who's not known as a great filmmaker, as a dutiful filmmaker.
Right.
You know.
That's the right word for him.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't know anymore whether you're going to have your, can you have your, well, I don't know, what are they doing in the, well, they're doing the Bryan Singer movie. Are they going to have German accents? Tom Cruise is the Nazi.
That's going to be funny. I'm sure it is going to be the German accent, right?
I don't know.
After.
Do you?
Well, they can't. They're going to diminish the box office by 70-80% of.
No, but are they going to do German accents or are they going to speak in normal English and you're going to assume that it's German?
I mean, that's
part of the gradient, isn't it? You have.
Yes. I don't know what to do. I wouldn't. It's a hard one. I'm trying to think of something that was. See, I didn't even know. It's funny. When I was watching Downfall with.
Right.
I didn't even think about it. I mean, it didn't. After a while, you don't think about it. Was it in English or was it in German?
No, it's in German.
Naturally in German.
Yeah.
But you don't think about it because it's such a good absorbing thing.
No, but if Tom Cruise has a German accent, it's going to be.
It's going to be a rough one.
And if you don't do that, then is it. I guess you just accept it. I mean, I don't know.
They've got to speak in a uniform way. It's like with ancient Roman epics. The system is they're British, and everybody else is. Well, they're not British, but the Romans are British. But that system works. Everybody understands that, right?
We require that now, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Aramaic. We've had our Aramaic film now. That's the best thing about that movie. Okay. Yeah, he's. I mean, and Apocalypto.
Yeah, yeah. So how did it break down with the? You had told me once that perhaps you would tell me how the. The who did what on the last which Bourne movies? All three, right? Or
I worked on all three. Yeah.
All three.
What kept me out of trouble, Jeff?
All right. Well,
you know what? This is what I'm going around saying. It's been 8 years. It's been very good for everybody.
Okay.
It's been a really interesting ride.
Okay.
Everybody's done very well for themselves. You know, it's really, and it's silly to complain about something that does so well. It just doesn't make any sense.
I'm not talking about the whole Doug Liman. I'm not even getting
into that. No. But the whole thing has been interesting. The whole 8 years has been, it's been very tumultuous and really, and it's been blessed all the way through. And you know, there's a couple people that have been there all the way from the very beginning. And every now and then we catch a look from each other. Holy shit. Can you believe what's happened? I saw Pat Crowley the other night, and he came to the screen. Pat's the only person who was there from the very, very beginning with me. He actually predates Frank. So we were there from the very, very, very beginning. So I saw Pat the other night, and we just look at each other and go, oh, God, I can't believe what we've been through.
What was your personal feeling about obviously being the having the perspective of going out of cut and everything? I felt that somehow the second one was giving me the heebie-jeebies, and I was getting irritated at the cutting in two of the sequences, maybe three of them. But I said, "You're pushing it too much. It's bothersome." I didn't get that from the ultimatum, from the last one.
I think it also depends where you sit in the theater. I think if you sit up close, you're screwed. If you sit in the back, where do you like to? What's your preferred seat? You have your choice seat in a movie theater. Where do you want to sit?
I'm actually more of a sort of close and center type of guy.
I'm a back left. Back left or right. I sit in the back of the theater. I think if you sit up close, if I think it's actually, I mean, it's sort of approaching the, you're into psycho-visual stuff. I think if you get to the point where the screen crosses a certain point of your peripheral vision, something else happens. I don't know. I'm not really.
The very first Supremacy screening, I saw it twice, was at the Writers Guild on Doheny, and literally a woman threw up.
I've read that. That's.
And I, you know, I just know all of a sudden people got up.
Oh,
there
God.
Was a commotion. Yeah.
Man.
And I was told, you know, don't you dare get into, you know, vomit on the floor, you know, and I didn't really put it together because I didn't think it was that bad. I just thought
someone just happened to
throw up. Yeah. I only later thought, oh, I see. They thought maybe there's a cause and effect. I mean, maybe there was, you know.
The most visceral reaction I've ever seen in the film was there were two people, but at the end of the remember the original Vanishing?
Yeah, yeah.
Never seen a reaction like that in my life before. When people realized what was happening. That's okay. Remember the end when he realized he's in the box? He's trapped in the box?
Yes. He starts laughing.
Oh, well, it's so hard. And this woman in front of us stood up in front of us and just went, oh my God. And she grabbed her chest. And I thought, oh, well, that's like dramatic. And her husband was there. And she keels over and collapses. And she has like this asthmatic like panic attack. Okay? Another woman on the other side of the aisle gets up to look at her, and then I was like, oh my God. Someday I want to work on something that does that.
Wow.
It gets people that way. But I don't know. I think I don't know the answer to that. There's been a lot of talk about cutting and psycho. How many cuts and.
Well, I got a tape and asked Walter Murch about that.
I saw that run, yeah.
And what did he say? 14, 15
There's a limit? Yeah, I know. Yeah, I don't know. There's a limit. That was really interesting, yeah. I don't know. And then the other question, what I was wondering from that is, does the... two things. One is, does the audience get more attenuated to it over time? And do video games make you more attenuated to it over time so you're actually able to absorb more cuts than someone else can absorb? And then does that become an addiction? Do you get addicted to cuts? Is that part of the experience? Is that part of the... is that activating part of your brain that you need to... or you expect to have activated when you're eating popcorn and sitting in the dark? I don't have many cuts. Probably have fewer cuts in this than in one reel of the...
I don't want to be averse to... I certainly don't want to, you know, kind of hide away in a concept of comfortable cutting. Like, I love the way The French Connection is cut, for instance. I don't think that that's stodgy. But by today's standards, it sort of is, almost. Even the chase sequence, you could probably run into an editor and they say, well, we could jazz it, punch that up a little bit. But that's a very well-cut sequence.
Yeah, but I mean, there's also there's a huge other element, and that was the whole reason behind the that was the reason why I think the first one was a successful in a way. I mean,
what was successful?
If you someone was waiting, I think we were just the lucky recipients of a lot of a sort of pregnant moment that was sort of seen. I was trying to get people involved in doing a kind of more intimate action picture for a while. I kept trying to find a place to put it.
Mm-hmm.
The difference is you can only amp it so many times. Finally, you're like Spinal Tap. You're at 11, and you're like, how much farther you can go? More cannons, mm-hmm. you know, more surrounds. But you put somebody that you give a shit about inside the car.
Mm-hmm.
You put a story inside the car. Everything changes. It doesn't have to be that. Then you can have a Mini Cooper drive down an alley in Paris, and it can be the same thing. Now, the cutting and the rest of it is just, you know, where you put the camera. But the element of involvement just... That's the secret ingredient. Because the rest of it is just a matter of throw weight. You just keep adding throw weight. It's sort of, you know, more faster, more cameras, more cuts, more louder.
I wanted to also compliment you. I'm thinking about the scene in which Tom Wilkinson is killed. And it's done, for those that don't want to spoil it for people who haven't seen the film, but it's done in a way that's... it's not done with brute malevolence. It's... The predominant feeling that I get from the two assassins is that they're very worried that they don't want to screw it up, and they want to get it right, and they want to do it quietly. And they're very into teamwork, and they're practiced. But you're almost, and this is the strangest response I can, but you're almost rooting for them to not screw it up so that, you know, because they're very, very into it, and they're not bad guys. They're just kind of dull functionaries, yeah. Technicians. And I love that you didn't emphasize you're supposed to hate these guys. Look at how, you know, venal they are. I mean, they're certainly, obviously, I wouldn't want to run into them in the course of my life, but they're kind of interesting guys. But I wish that you had shown something happened to them somehow.
But what I'm doing...
Maybe get another job. Something,
no, but, you know, but you know? What I'm trying to do at the end is that,
yeah.
You know, the thing in the cab was such a big get for me because it did it did several things for me. Mm-hmm. When I finally came up with that shot was... Number one, I have sort of this really big feel-good moment at the end of the picture, right? The really big triumphant thing. And you see with a huge audience, and people like, you know, there's just applause and tables turn and all. But I didn't want to go out. I mean, that's not consistent with the tone of the rest of the picture. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to finish on this, like... So I wanted to recalibrate the vibe. That's the first thing. The second thing is I want... Hopefully, for anybody who's going to sit there... I don't know how many theaters across the country... Mm-hmm. You're actually going to leave the lights down when you're on George's face there in the cab. But I also wanted, just for anybody who was going to make the effort, to sort of say, what's going to happen in the next hour? What's going to happen in the next week? I mean, it's sort of inevitable what's going to happen. This is this cascading trail of shit that's going to, the whole thing is going to come down. If you just sit there, it's not hard to posit what's going to happen to everybody in the next few hours,
mm-hmm.
or the next few weeks. And
mm-hmm.
So... I sort of wanted that. I mean, in addition, I wanted to have George's face. I wanted to, but you know, it's my version of the, you know, the crawl at the end of American Graffiti or something. This is what happened to everybody down the line. I mean, it's not too hard to figure out what's going to happen.
That was the greatest closing credit sequence because you don't cut to black. I so love it when you held on it. I don't know how long it lasted.
It's like 2.5 minutes, yeah.
Okay. This is, for those who haven't seen it, it ends with George Clooney in the back of a cab, reflecting, feeling all these things. There's a sense of finality, of closure, of having turned a page, whatever. But it's but you put the credits, and I love that you don't put them too big either. It's almost for cinema alone, because when it goes on DVD, it's going to be really tiny, those credits, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think...
The size.
Yeah,
the
no, I mean, I think we want to...
That was really cool.
Yeah, no, it's they're modest and clean and... You know, they're sure confident. They're confident.
I'm sure someone said, "Hey, these aren't big enough."
You know, if George and I are willing to have it like that, then everybody else has to take it. So that's the way it works.
Right.
It's also nice to have tail credits. You know, I like tail credits.
Yeah.
But again, that's, you know, you have to get people to agree to do that.
Now, what was the process? I've read this, but I thought I would like to get it from your point of view. Is that Tilda Swinton uses her anatomy in a way that's really interesting. She makes her character, who's, again, in lesser hands, would be a typically, villainous, malevolent woman of pure evil, and yet because she's willing to not be in toned up and in perfect shape, there's something affecting about that. Vulnerable, adds a layer of intrigue about who she is. But she does this underwear shot that's really kind of... I just really love that she was willing to do that and that you thought of that or she went along
with
it.
All the way... She's just so brave. Have you ever met her and talked to her? She's amazing.
Once.
Yeah, I mean, she's just... I mean, it wasn't even really... It wasn't like we ever even had a discussion saying, oh, you know, I really want to... I want to see your... there was never any conversation like that. It was just... her bravery, it was just... presents itself right from the very beginning. So it was, she was up for anything.
Yep.
And, you know, I had a question. Someone asked me this remarkable. So every now and then you get some guy in France came in and he had like, you know, it was one of those 4-minute little television junkie pieces. And he came in and he said, he goes, I know everyone else wants to talk about everything. I want to talk about the sweat. He goes, we see her sweat. He goes, I think sweat is more powerful than a gun or an orgasm. It's something we haven't seen. I want to talk about the bravery of showing this sweat. He goes, that's the one thing we never see in films. you know, she's an actor who, she built her performance by the earrings. I mean, when we found her the earrings and finding the shoes and that, everything for her is to build it from the outside in. And part of that was her, you know, letting herself go and being really uncomfortable in her body and being uncomfortable everywhere. It's a very uncomfortable. I just upstairs this morning, I was just waking up and they had a show on this morning on, I don't know what channel, but someone's got a book out called Fembots. Have you heard this term?
Yeah, I have.
You have? I never heard it before.
I
had like a whole discussion about kind of what she's the worst example of. This whole new... women completely cut off from anything, and how much. So she is. I never heard this. It's brand new, fresh. Fembot. So, I mean, she really is.
The writing of the scene in which she hires or makes the decision with the senior pit guy is brilliant because none of them say what he's going to do, but it's clear what she's hinting at, and he understands it, and so do we. It's really good.
I'm as proud of that as anything. You know, people talk, that it's interesting because that scene is, there's some flashy, you know, you write a 4-page monologue and everybody, you know, that's what's considered, wow, that's great screenplay, a big 4-page monologue.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's sort of the writing equivalent of a car chase. You know, people say, oh, wow, great car chase, great direction.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the hardest part to do. Is much more. I'm much more proud of the scenes where people don't say what they're about, and that's a scene that can really fall apart. It has to be really finely calibrated, and I'm as proud of that scene as anything in the movie.
Now, you've obviously proved your mettle, and you're a bona fide, you know, high level director in the director's club, as it were.
I don't know about that. About that, Jeff. Really?
There's a.
As of this morning, maybe, I don't know.
Billy Wilder, a lot of people, Preston Sturges, a lot of people, anybody, I'm sure, who has ever...
I think you better wait for a couple more pictures before you say that. But
well...
But yeah, go ahead, yeah.
You've done a sturdy job, man.
Right, a sturdy job, there you go.
And there hasn't been a screenwriter alive who hasn't said, they're screwing it up. My work is much better than what they're turning this screenplay into. I'm going to direct.
Right.
Not only Johnson wanted to do that. I think he wound up directing in the 50s, didn't he?
Yeah,
But John Ford is quoted as saying to him, not only directors have to be SOBs, and you're not enough of an SOB to be a director.
I don't believe that.
Are you finished, gentlemen?
I don't think that's the defining characteristic. I don't know about that. I mean,
what do you think the defining character? What did you share with Wilder and Preston Sturges and guys who?
I don't think
everybody wanted to do it. Is what I'm trying to say. Yeah. And
well, look, they're very different skill sets. I mean, it's not. You have to be. I think it's too hard to be a writer and be. You have to be social. You have to be able to want to be around people.
Which is a lot of writers do not have.
Yeah, no, it's not. It's not a common trait. I mean, I find some common traits among screenwriters. It's really hard to find. I think there's a couple things that are really vaguely uniform.
Mm-hmm.
Is
that coffee, by the way?
Yeah.
You want to sit up for them?
Let's see how we're doing. Maybe we got enough.
I'll give you a fresh one.
No, no, don't waste it. We're good. Okay. But, man, I don't believe that SOB theory. I don't believe the theory that making movies is going to war. I never liked that idea. That's not how we made this movie. I wouldn't want to make a movie that way. I think it's, you know, you're sort of relying on, you're sort of relying on pulling all these other people you really want to inspire all these people. You want to get these great people around. You want to inspire them. You want everybody pulling for the same thing. And I've worked on movies where people are in opposition to everything that's going on, and it's just such a grind. I mean, it doesn't show up on the screen. You don't get everybody's best work, and you have a miserable time doing it. I don't see that. That's true. I mean, John Ford needed to be an SOB, I guess, forever. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that completely.
Brian De Palma, famous for having once said when he went on a set, "There's too much laughing. People are having too good a time. I do not like that.
I agree with
that. I want that to stop right now."
Well, I do think that that's, I mean, I think that that's...
That's funny.
I'll tell you one thing that we did with... We got just ready to start the movie, and we had a really nice, long pre-production, and I went back and I was looking at the... Because we were working with Robert Elswit, and I went back and looked at the... I think it was the companion DVD that was in Magnolia, The Making of Magnolia, and because I'm such a, you know, huge fan of Paul Anderson's, and watching it, I was like, watching them do all this stuff, and I realized there were no final touch-ups. There was no makeup on the set. It was, like, sparse, and there was nobody there. I was like, I said to Robert, I said, man, what is this? He said, is that how you shoot every day? He goes, oh, yeah, because Paul doesn't, there's no, you know, it's really minimal set, very few people around. Mm-hmm. And I go, no final touch-ups? He goes, no. And I've never been on a movie that didn't have that. So it worked for this film as well, because there's nobody's looking good. So I banished... We had no final touch. I mean, it's a very bizarre ritual when you think of it. You get everybody ready. Mm-hmm. You get everybody tuned up. You rehearse. You're ready to go. You're ready to start rolling. You're in the moment. And then all of a sudden, 14 people come scurrying in and do all this shit to everybody's face and fuck around with them. And then they step back, and then you're supposed to go. It always seems so unnatural to me. Now, there's pictures where it's important. But we just... So I said, can I do that? He goes, well, you're the director. You can do whatever you want. So I said, all right, we're not having any final touch-ups. No, we started, no final touch-ups. We just like, and whenever we could, I know what he's saying. You don't want to have, any vibe that, you don't want to have any, it's sort of, what's the equivalent? You know, you don't want to have a smell in a dining room. You don't have any other smell from any other meal in the dining room. You sort of just want to have the meal present itself that day. So I buy that. But you don't have to be a son of a bitch to get it.
Pre-strike.
Yeah, to get off in March. Yeah. What did you? We can go another couple minutes. We're okay.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Just wanted to remind you that you have
that. I know. Okay, we'll go. We're okay. Okay. We're good.
Off in March and finish by what, everyone has mid-May
to
or something.
Everyone has to finish by June. You have to finish by June 30th. You can't go. But I don't know. I started here yesterday that they're going to call strike November 1st. All of a sudden, everybody's like, that's...
Which guild?
That the writers are going to... That's what I heard. All of a sudden, I mean, that rumor started around yesterday. I don't know if that's real or not.
What would be the point of that? Because they're not preparing for it? And therefore...
That's part of it. I mean, they're definitely going to get the strike authorization. That vote will come in on the 18th, and that'll be arousing. I mean, you know, but the authority to strike... I don't know. I guess it'd be to catch everybody unaware, and then also, you know, all these movies that are gearing up to start shooting in March, there's a lot of rewrite work out there right now because a lot of movies that aren't really ready. So that would be part of it. And then I think also, I don't know, to make sure that the DGA doesn't make a separate deal, or I don't know. I don't know that, but I just started hearing that.